You're listening to By the Well, a weekly podcast for preachers where we delve into the lectionary readings to help you preach in your context. I'm Robin Whittaker.
And I'm Fran Barber. This week is the second week of Lent. We encounter the theologically groundbreaking narrative of Abraham's call in Genesis 12, 1-4, and its commentary in Paul's letter to the Romans in chapter 4 there, where Paul extends the blessing in fundamental ways. And a reading from John, Nicodemus's conversation with Jesus and Nicodemus's failure to grasp the life-giving power of God. If you're preaching on the Matthew reading in the lectionary this week, the Transfiguration, can we direct you to our conversation with Professor Dorothy Lee 2 weeks ago, February the 23rd, for the Transfiguration.
That's right. Today we're going to be focusing on Genesis 12 most of all. We'll have a look at those New Testament texts as well. But this is such a rich text, and we get a whole lot of Genesis in the lectionary this year that we'll be focusing on when we get to those narratives as they're picked up after Easter. So just to locate us here, in Genesis 12, there's a bit of a shift in the text. The first 11 chapters or so have been what scholars sometimes call these primeval narratives. A lot of them are mythical. They seem to happen not in any particular historical context. We've got creation, we've got flood, we've got violence and chaos and murder and angels coming down to interbreed with humans. We're sort of in this mythical space.
Yeah.
And with Abraham, we start a kind of a historical narrative, really, and one that becomes deeply personal and grounded in a particular family and a particular place.
Yeah. And as I think Brueggemann says, we interpret chapter 12 onwards with Genesis 1 to 11, like they need to be read together.
Yes.
And interpreting each other.
Yeah, there's a reason the editors, I think, of Genesis put all of this together into what was one text. But we're going to journey now with Abraham and Abraham's descendants really for a lot of the scriptures that follow.
Yeah. So perhaps the first thing we might notice in looking at the text is Abraham's name.
Yes, Abram, which will become Abraham, and also the place he comes from. He comes from the land of Ur, which is difficult to locate precisely. There's a few Urs referenced in the Bible, but most scholars think this is Ur of the Chaldeans, which is in modern-day Iraq. It was a place of the ancient world that became Babylon. But the point is, there's of course no Israel at this point in the story. so we've got a man who – there's no Judaism at this point either.
And I think that's a really important point. It's like sometimes people – assume Jesus was Christian.
Yes, exactly.
No, he was a Jew and is now synonymous with Christianity, obviously.
Yeah. But that's right.
So in a similar way, Abraham
probably worshipped a whole lot of foreign gods, maybe Baal and other gods associated with later Babylonian religion or Sumerian religion before that. And it's modern day Iraq. So I wonder how we'd hear this story of Abraham, who's this amazing exemplar of faith in not just the Jewish and Christian traditions, but also
the
Muslim one. Yep. As you know, Abraham from Iraq, Abraham the Iraqi, is called by God. We've got the beginning of many, many stories in the Bible of an unlikely character. We get younger sons, we get barren women, we get, you know, these unlikely characters, outsiders.
And very old.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that is a key theological theme here, is what God can do with barrenness. And the contrast with the end of chapter 11, where we're told that Abraham is really old and that Sarah was barren. And then God speaks and is nonetheless going to use these people to forward his promise as a new strategy, really, to deal with the violence and chaos that humans continue to wreak on one another. But I was just pointing out Abraham's name, really, because this is like God speaks and God names. This is the God we worship is the God who speaks, and the God who names says it's good. This is light. This is good. And that Abraham will have a new identity after his response, and then his name is changed. So it's worth noting, I think.
Yes,
that here
and again, not the only. I mean, Jacob will be called Israel.
Yeah,
Saul will be called Paul.
Yeah.
Not the only one. I don't know. There's so many themes here. I don't know where to start. One is obviously of journey and movement.
Yeah, I think I'd like to interject here. So this passage is scandalously, radically different theologically. It would have been really disturbing to read. Mm-hmm. So we've already mentioned that Abraham was in a context of where people worshipped many gods, Baal, and gods were considered to be quite capricious and inhabited things like rain and stones and rocks.
Associated with nature and
fertility
storms.
And so on. And it's really instructive to look at 1 Kings 18 and 19 and Elijah and the 450 prophets of Baal and what's going on in that story, because what we have is a radical paradigm shift from the naturalistic idea that we all return to the same thing, like the seasons. There's just this circle that we're all moving in. We've got no way out of it. Yep. This sort of fateful thing. And what happens in Genesis 12 is this paradigm shifts to one of history where Abraham is sent and God becomes incarnate in history, not in the rocks and the stones to be worshipped in that way at all, but to be journeying with
people.
People.
Yes.
And the fickleness of that, God opening God's self up to the fickleness of that and the danger of it, as the people did too when they responded. So you can see in that story in Kings that Elijah, they're looking for the gods to respond.
Yep.
And the God of the Hebrews isn't in the earthquake, the wind and the fire, but is in the sound of the silence, the voice that speaks, the still small voice.
Yeah.
So this is really
it's a major theological shift.
Massive,
It's the beginning of what we would later come to know as Judaism, with a focus on one God and a God who is personal and a God who has elected or chosen this one nation. So, I mean, Christians talk about the scandal of the particular with Jesus, that God chose to become incarnate in this highly particular way in one culture at one time. But we have a scandal of particularity back here with the Abraham story in choosing this one man. And on a similar theme, the Old Testament scholar Dennis Olson talks about this story being a radical affirmation of God's involvement with humanity, and particularly when we see it in the context of those 11 chapters that precede it, where there's almost a narrative of human failure, violence, increasing chaos, increasing bad behavior. And yet at this point, we then get a narrative of God choosing to work with and through a particular human.
And an unlikely one, as we've said.
Yeah, exactly. So we've given some context to Abraham, and obviously he's important here, but arguably the main character's God. Fran, what's God doing in this story, or might we think of that?
Well, I think that's it's a good thing to keep in mind if you're preparing a sermon or a Bible study on this, that the particularity of Abraham is really important in its unlikeliness and his being just a nobody human, but this isn't a story primarily, as Fleming Rutledge says, about anthropology. It's about theology. This is about this remarkable God who calls, as we've said, and speaks and creates out of nothing. I think some have called this a sort of a resurrection text almost, because out of the barrenness we've heard in chapter 11, I'm going to bless
life.
You. Yeah. So significant textually here is the number of times that God says I.
Yes, there's a lot of I will, first person divine speech.
I will make of you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you, I will curse, and so on. Mm. So this is about the creative power of God, and it's a command, a command and a promise or an assurance. So it's both and. Here.
Yeah, it's a call or a command, really. Go forth, go. It's a very strong go, you go. But then all these promises in between, and then it's only in verse 4 after hearing God speak that we get told, and Abraham went forth.
Yeah.
So he hears, but he also hears the promises, and arguably on the basis of those promises, he is ready to leave.
So it's not about human potential, actually, this story.
No.
It's about what God has promised to do. And I think the theme of promise could be quite an interesting one to take in a sermon.
Yeah.
We make promises that we can't keep sometimes because we really want to help people. We really want, you know, people to feel cared for. And what's so significant in terms of faith repeatedly is that we see in the scriptures that God keeps God's promises in ways that we can't.
Yeah. And I actually think a large part of the role of any preacher or Christian leader in a community is to remind people of God's promises. Like, particularly in liberal churches, when we've stopped reading the Bible, we've stopped studying it, or not stopped, that's overstating it, obviously, but there's less and less focus on reading the Bible and that sort of daily devotion. And yet when we stop doing that, we stop seeing ourselves in these stories. And the grand narrative of Scripture is about God's faithfulness to us. So, yes, Abraham's an exemplar of faith, but ultimately this is a story not of Abraham's faith but of God's faithfulness towards humanity.
And a challenging sermon could be thinking about, well, challenging your community. Are you embarrassed by this idea of by this God we believe in who speaks, who actually says stuff, and in sort of mysterious, ambiguous ways we hear it? And dealing with that, because some of us are a bit embarrassed by that idea, that sort of what does that mean? What is it?
Or worse, maybe think God has stopped speaking or don't know how to hear God speaking.
Yeah, or demythologized it away.
Yes, that's true.
It's something, in this modern world, this is not something we can.
We don't do this kind
of
thing.
We're above that, you know. And what we have here is just in the Scriptures entirely.
Yeah.
Is constant reminder that no, actually, God does have the power and the desire.
Yeah.
To be with us and to promise.
Yep.
And to speak.
And it's our job to remind people that God is faithful, and God, and to remind, people of, there's numerous promises. We see God's fulfillment of promises throughout the Scripture and beyond.
Yeah, and what I think if we have a look at Hebrews 11, which talks about Abraham, as the exemplar of faith, is that the promise is fulfilled, but not necessarily in the time that we expect it, i.e. this generation instantly. So we see in Hebrews that Abraham didn't see what God promised, as neither did Moses. And I think that's salutary and somewhat liberating, I hope, for people in congregations and communities who feel perhaps a bit sad or despairing about
what
the future might look like. Maybe they're much older and they remember some time in the 50s when that big blip happened.
When there was a church boom that was actually quite non-typical.
Yeah.
But, yep.
And the church, this is a big enterprise, and as in it's over time and generations and communion of the saints sort of stuff. So,
yeah, I feel like there's both comfort and harshness in and Abraham's not the only one. So Abraham, God tells Abraham, this land will be for your descendants. Abraham will never see this land. He's working for something that is way beyond his lifetime. Moses too will get to the cusp of the promised land but never enter it. I think the word of rebuke here to Christian communities who become, as they decline in particular, our tendency as humans to become increasingly inward focused on preserving what we have. If we're preserving what we have for our own sake, we've entirely missed the point of what is faithful response to God. But like you said, the comfort there is we may be working towards something that we don't see the immediate results of, but will hopefully live long after us.
Yeah.
So, and other future generations will benefit from our faithfulness.
And there's grounded hope in that.
Yes.
If it's scripturally understood and
that's pride. Right. There's a basis to that hope. One of the things preachers could do this week, or in fact invite a member of the congregation to do, is to do some sort of testimony about either their own sense of call, their journey in faith. I mean, there's a chance to speak personally and to, almost make some parallels. It's not that, people have stopped behaving faithfully like Abraham. And neither was Abraham perfect in some way that we are not. He makes numerous mistakes in this story.
Pretends Sarah's his sister.
I know, does some dodgy things along the way and yet still ultimately follows God's call. It made me think, I actually relate to the story quite strongly because I grew up as a preacher's kid and, we moved house, I think, on average every 2 years. We moved country several times. Moving to follow God's call seemed to me an entirely normal thing to do. And, in fact, in my experience, it's not that there's never cost to it, but came with blessing and a sense of adventure and that this is what Christian life is all about. It's not about staying in the same place necessarily. Some callings can look like that.
And that was again, quite radical in the text at this time, because as we've already talked about, the gods of Baal were considered to be located in one place and to be pacified and so on. And here's this radical change where God calls and sends into history. And journey becomes quite a radical new thing. It's got a little cliche, unfortunately, sometimes in how we talk about it, despite the fact that in the New Testament, being a Christian disciple is referred to as the way.
Yeah, that's right.
The way of the cross, the way of suffering, the way of Jesus.
No, that's right. And, I mean, the other thing you've just made me think of, Fran, is this Abraham is sent. He goes forth. And, of course, that becomes the dominant mode of discipleship in the New Testament. The apostles are all sent. The disciples are called. They follow. They all leave. To be an apostle, to be a follower of Christ is really to be a sent one. To be any kind of minister is to be a sent one. Now, you might get sent 3Ks down the road. You might get sent to the other side of the world. But the whole point is there's movement, I think.
Yeah, and that so therefore the call comes with risk,
yes,
and unknownness, and security and safety looks like it's where if you stay put, that's what you'll have. But God's promising actually, it feels like that.
Yes,
but if you are sent by me,
yep,
your ultimate experience will be security and safety.
Yeah,
I'm not promising it won't be precarious and.
Sometimes dangerous, sometimes uncomfortable. Yep. That there's not some cost in leaving. I mean, Abraham never gets to return. There's cost in leaving those relationships behind to form this new family and ultimately new nation.
This is following a God who does the same thing.
Yes, exactly.
Who attaches God's self to the people and seeks relationship constantly every time they fall out of it with him.
Yep. No, I think that's right. So as we think about preaching themes and move more into sort of how we think about applying or how this story relates to our lives today, it struck me that, you know, it can work at least two levels as a kind of metaphor or something to reflect with. So obviously we've already touched on the personal journey of faith, how our own journeys, we could ask ourselves some questions or discuss some questions in our communities about, you know, when are times we've had to start over? Where has God been with us? Whether it's starting over sometimes from tragedy that we have no control over and wouldn't choose, or it's starting over because we've chosen something we feel God is calling us to do. When have there been times that we have found ourselves being used as a blessing, you know, that we've, you know, our action has somehow blessed others or been life-giving for others? When have there been times we've discerned God's support? So there's a lot of personal reflective work we could do with this.
We could. I think that can be in danger of making it an anthropological passage and not a theological one.
Okay.
That would be my concern. So this is primarily about God and a radical new understanding of God.
Mm-hmm.
And what does that actually look like now, today?
So how would you answer that then, Fran?
Well,
do you want to think? I mean, I think there's a word here for the church too as community because, of course, we aren't just individuals. We only know God through and with community.
Yeah.
Including this very ancient one whose words come down to us. But how you're wanting to push more on how we hear God or where God is at work today? Is that what I'm hearing?
Well, yes. I think so.
Yeah.
I think those pastoral questions are really important, but I guess I would be thinking, how is God understood today popularly?
Okay.
And what does this passage do to speak to that,
to redress that? Yep.
So I'm thinking about if you're having some God talk perhaps with your friend at the pub or at the cafe, and what are the assumptions around how God operates if they use the word at all, and how does this passage radically alter those?
Yeah.
I think it's an opportunity for that sort of, and even how God is talked about in the conversation in Australia.
That's right.
I mean,
yes.
Often with a lot of ignorance and so on. But so I think the passage has got a lot of power for people who want to approach it that way.
Yes.
Although bearing in mind, as you say, those pastoral and important personal
and
questions about journey and faith. And whose journey, I mean, whose journey are we on? Is it our personal journey? A bit. But it's actually God's on it. And we're in God's story and this is it unfolding.
Yes.
And take ourselves from the centre of it in that way.
No, that's true, because it's, you know, any reflection needs to have some sense of personal awareness, but ultimately this is not about us. Christian calling is not about us. Abraham's calling was not about him. It's always the blessed to be a blessing to the benefit of others, and it should always be pointing to God, not back at ourselves. So that's,
yeah. And it could be perhaps a slightly smaller theme you could talk about. Lent, what does blessing look like? I mean, we've touched on that earlier in our episodes beginning the year on Matthew.
But blessing, not money.
No.
Not a big house.
No. So that'd be an interesting conversation to have in Lent.
Yes, yeah.
What does it mean to be blessed?
Blessed. Let's turn our attention to what Paul does with this in Romans.
Yes. So in many respects, I think Paul extends the blessing to the Gentiles and to those beyond. So it's not just Israel.
Yep.
And it's not just those who follow the Jewish law, but all people who are embraced by the faith of Abraham.
Yep.
Which touches on the universalism I was claiming for Paul last week's episode.
Yes, in Romans 5 when we were talking about that, first part of Romans
5. Yeah, so I'm sure many a New Testament scholar might have quibbles with Paul's, well, interpretation and our reading that into
There's only
the
been about
one.
5 billion pages written on how to interpret Romans. But, yeah, I think you're – and, I mean, universal salvation is its own theological debate, which is interestingly becoming quite a hot topic again at the moment in 2019 and 2020. But I think you're right, Paul, there is and this is its own new radicalness that happens in earliest Christianity, which is the opening up of this sense of blessing and chosenness and election from what has now become a much more clearly identified people of Israel to Gentile converts.
So, yes, salvation is then located in faith and faithful response or participation in a faith and not in genealogy.
Yes.
Or, I mean blood genealogy.
Yeah. Or nationhood
so,
or tribalism.
So, yeah, he expands the inheritance
else.
Significantly.
Yeah.
Which is great news.
Mm. And do we need to say anything about the John passage if people are trying to make some links? Do you see any thematic links with John 3?
Just a bigger picture one where when we see Abraham responding to being sent and to God's call, Abraham responds, he goes, simply says he goes. He doesn't say, so if I do that, God, what's it going to look like? What should I bring? What about the fact that I'm 104 or however old he says he is? Whereas Nicodemus, we have him in conversation with Jesus about eternal life, very scholarly questions. He's a teacher. He's got all the worldly attributes and all the worldly advantages of someone who should be able to understand what Jesus is getting at. And unlike Abraham, who has not got those things, he doesn't grasp the saving radical power of God and what life is in Jesus.
Yep.
So I suppose I see that's a sort of a contrast you can draw perhaps.
Yeah.
In the passages and in responses to faith journey. I mean, that, you know, getting back to the faith journey thing.
Well, I was going to say, for, you know, at the risk of, you know, flogging the horse more, you know, it points to the fact that faith and understanding that comes through faith, faithful following of Jesus, is that journeying. It's not that we have one conversation and understand all the answers or one aha moment. We might have those wonderful transformative revelatory experiences, but it's often an accumulation of them over a lifetime. No single one of them is going to reveal everything we need to know for a faithful life.
And what we might think should be helping us might be the barrier.
Yes, yeah, that this is not about learnedness or all the skills or, I mean, we don't really know anything about Abraham. He might have been an incredibly
learned chap,
or he could have just been anybody.
But it wasn't described as that in the passage.
No, exactly.
Whereas
that wasn't important.
The Nicodemus one, the author of John does emphasize that. So that's a sort of a big picture point, I would say.
Yeah. Any other last words as we wrap up today I think we've touched on a number of sort of major themes.
Yep. Do you believe that God calls and speaks?
Yeah. And where do we hear God continuing to speak? How do we hear that? I think sometimes we've got to revisit these basics of just, you know, we as preachers might say, you know, discerning how God's calling you or how God's speaking. Mm. Well, what does that actually look like?
And there are long traditions, particularly our Catholic brothers and sisters who know very, you know, wonderful prayer traditions and so on that really lead us in that.
Yeah. No, that's right.
So,
and we haven't talked about prayer much, but I mean, obviously, if you're not reading the Bible and you're not praying, you know, those are two obvious places to start.
Yeah.
We're not going to hear God's word if we're not in the places where we're particularly attentive to it and looking for it.
And in a community context, keeping us accountable for what we're interpreting.
Yep.
Or, you know, helping us along or correcting. It's what the church is for everybody.
Yep. Well, thank you, everybody, for listening along with us today as we've explored a bit of the story of Abraham and some of the themes and ways that it continues to speak with us today.
This podcast is made with the support of the Uniting Church in Australia and Pilgrim Theological College and the technical genius of Adrian Jackson. Thanks for listening.
Bye.